been a while since we last had the Tuesday night share, but it's good to be back in session. And this series, for Shirim, I want to look at some contemporary Shaylot that come up with regard to various life cycle events. We're going to look this week at issues to do with birth, conception, Brit Milah and Pidyon HaBen, so the beginning of life. Next week we'll look at Bar and Bat Mitzvah. The following week we'll look at wedding, marriage and divorce. And then the following week we'll look at issues in death and burial. And as I've said so many times, a lot of the contemporary questions are really old questions, just in a slightly new guise, repackaged. They're timeless issues. But in actual fact, as far as issues to do with birth and conception are concerned, I'd say this is an area of halakha where that's simply not true. And I once heard a very distinguished posek say, with regard to issues of fertility treatments and things like this, that these were even issues that, you know, had never occurred to Chazal. So, you know, very often with issues, you know, we're looking at Chazal don't quite discuss our case, but they discuss analogous cases, and we can extrapolate from them. But this is something which is so new and something which was so inconceivable, if one can be excused the play on words, so inconceivable, 2,000 years ago, and even 100 years ago, that it's very difficult to find out how Chazal would have ruled in these issues. So a few years ago, meaning maybe 20, 30 years ago, the topic that one would discuss, as far as this is concerned, one would start off by talking about IVF, where the egg is fertilized outside of the womb. Certain questions of donor sperm, husband sperm, etc., etc. In a halachic and scientific sense, IVF is already old hat. There's been a lot of discussion about it over the past 50 years. And I want to touch on this evening two much more recent developments. One is the question of surrogate parenthood, and the other is the question of egg donation, and linked with the question of three-parent babies, which both are pretty recent developments in the scientific world. So surrogate motherhood has been around for some years already, and surrogate motherhood is where the egg is fertilized outside of the womb and is then incubated, if you like, or grown in another mother's womb. This scenario happens usually when a woman doesn't have a womb for whatever reason. It can happen very occasionally that a woman's born without a womb. She still has ovaries, so she's still producing eggs. She's fertile, but she's got nowhere where a fetus can grow. So in this case, the eggs are extracted from the woman. They're fertilized with her husband's sperm, and then they're implanted in the womb of another woman to grow. And the second woman, the surrogate mother, she actually gives birth to the baby. So the question here is, who's the mother of this baby? And this is going to be very important because it's going to be relevant in a number of halakhic areas. It's going to be relevant in terms of questions to do with yichus and relationship. You know, who's this baby's sister and brother that they can't marry? Who are the parents? And in some instances, it's even going to relate to the question of Jewish identity. If the host mother, surrogate mother, is not Jewish, but the egg and the sperm come from Jewish parents. So then, who's the, is the child Jewish? Do we say we're looking at the genetic mother, which is the mother of the egg, or are we looking at the birthing mother? And that, of course, is the non-Jewish mother in that case. So you could have the situation the other way around, where a Jewish woman acts as a surrogate, a host host mother for somebody else. So if the other person is not Jewish, what's the status of that child which is born? And needless to say, there's a machloket about this. The poskim are inconclusive about this. Though, some of them have, some of the poskim do have very clear views on the matter. I want to flag up three shitot. There is, actual fact, a fourth logical shita here, which we'll mention as well. But in the Makorot that I've shared with you, I want to start with a teshuva of Rav Shlomo Amar. Rav Shlomo Amar was... 10 years ago, he was the Sfardi Rishon Tzion, the Sfardi chief rabbi of Israel. And he was asked this question. And he says as far, it's got on the front front page here. He says that he consulted with Rav Avadia Yosef. And Rav Avadia Yosef and he were both of the opinion that the halachic mother is the genetic mother. That where did the egg come from? Whoever produced the egg, then that's the mother, as far as all halakhot are concerned. And he says that therefore the baby doesn't need geirut of any sort after it's born. And even if you did geirut lechumra, the baby wouldn't be regarded as a ger and therefore would be allowed to marry a kohen. Etc., etc. They are of the opinion that essentially using a host mother is no different to growing a baby outside of a womb. If something could be done that you didn't need to put the baby into a womb, but you could fertilize the egg outside of a womb and then incubate it and grow it in some sort of incubator, some sort of synthetic womb or mechanical womb, then there'd be no question about who the mother is. Nobody would say this this child is the baby from a robot. There's no such thing as a baby from a robot. So the fact that the fetus has been stored in another woman's womb, Rav Avadia and Rav Shlomo Amar and others are of the opinion that in actual fact that's not of any halachic relevance. And that the mother, for all purposes, is the genetic mother. So that's the view of Rav Amar and Rav Avadia Yosef. There's another opinion which is diametrically opposed, and that's the view of Rav Eliashiv. Rav Eliashiv is cited as saying, number one, he says that you shouldn't really do this. He's not. He's not happy that this is happening. He says because it can cause confusion. That just as people will think that you can have two mothers involved in the birth of a child, you could also have two fathers involved in the birth of a child, and that definitely would lead to issues of mamzerut or lack of clarity about who the father is. I'm not sure how you could have. Two fathers involved, really, in terms of you take the sperm, even if you mix the sperm, ultimately the sperm that fertilizes the egg is going to be of one or other of the fathers. So I'm not sure what he means by that. But in any event, he says that it's his opinion that the birth mother is the real mother. And therefore, if the birth mother is not Jewish, the child will need to be converted, because when does one get one's Jewish status? One gets one's Jewish status at the moment of birth. You're not Jewish until you're born. It's emerging from the womb, which defines you as being Jewish. And therefore, Rav Avadia is of the opinion that Rav Eliashiv is the opinion that the birth mother is the defining mother as far as halacha is concerned. Something that I wonder about, and I don't have an answer to this question, is what if you had a fetus that was developing in the genetic mother's womb, perhaps created through a conventional act of intercourse, and then for some reason the mother, let's say, became ill and wasn't able to have the fetus in the womb any longer, and they were to transfer the fetus from the genetic mother's womb to a host mother's womb. I don't know at what stage, but maybe after 2 months, they were able to transplant the fetus from the genetic mother into a host mother. So according to Rav Eliashiv, who's the birth mother there? Because the fetus was conceived in utero of the genetic mother and was extracted from the womb of the genetic mother. Now, it wasn't yet a viable fetus, but nevertheless, it was extracted. It's no different, really, to a C-section. And if the host mother had to have a C-section, according to Rav Eliashiv, that's the mother the baby is born from and gets its Jewish or non-Jewish identity. So what if the baby's born twice, as it were? It's extracted. What if the baby's, I don't know if this would be possible, but at least, theoretically, let's say it's at 6 months, the baby was extracted from the birth, from the genetic mother, implanted in a host mother, and then born, then extracted a second time from the host mother. I don't know what Rav Eliashiv would say there. Rav Moshe Sternbach, in a tshuva that I've brought to your attention, he actually says that there's no halachic mother. He says in this instance, there is no halachic mother. The halachic definition of a mother is the woman who provides the genetic material for conception and who gives birth to that child. And if you're absent either of those factors, so then there's no halachic mother. Of course, this is on the face of it a little bit strange, because it's impossible that a person doesn't have a mother. And I don't think that Rav Moshe Sternbach is saying that this person doesn't have a mother. I think he's just saying in halachic terms, the person has no mother whatsoever. And of course, this has implications. It means that if a woman has two children by this means, let's say a woman is a host mother, and a host mother has maybe two, three children by these means, none of them will be regarded as her children. If they're not Jewish, they will, if she's not Jewish, they will have to convert. And even if she is Jewish, they would be allowed to marry each other because they're not related to each other. They don't share a common mother. She was simply an incubator for them. And even if they shared a genetic mother, they would not be related to each other. So I suppose you could even have the situation where you have triplets born to the one genetic mother in the one host mother, and halachically those three triplets would not be regarded as as being related to each other. So that's what I regard as a fairly interesting question. The fourth possibility, of course, is that the person has two halachic mothers. And there are poskim who at least raise that as a possibility. And again, is it physically possible for a person to have more than one mother? No. But is it halakhically possible? Then the answer is yes. I mean, I suppose physically it could be possible also to have more than one mother, depending on how we're going to define motherhood. But what we're seeing here is that the halakhic notion of motherhood does not necessarily have to square up with a physical notion of motherhood at all. So that's the question of surrogate parenthood. The next question is with regard to three-parent babies. In very much layman's terms, what are three-parent babies? Three-parent babies are where you've got one father, and the genetic material for the egg comes from two mothers. Usually it's in a case where the genetic mother, the mother who's producing and providing the egg, she has some genetic disorder which can cause the child that's conceived to have a particular illness, and therefore some of the genetic material of her egg is removed and is replaced with genetic material from another woman's egg. So essentially you've got an egg not with two yolks, but it's more like an egg with two whites. In terms of I think it's called mitochondrial replacement. So a certain part of the egg is replaced and comes from another woman. So here, and then it might be going back into the genetic mother's womb. So it's a different question to the host mother. But here we've got really three partners in the genetic makeup. Now, if we say that the mother is simply defined by the birth mother, if we follow the position of Rav Eliashiv, then we're very clear in this case also, there's one father and there's one mother. The mother is the mother who gives birth. If we look at the other poskim, then they say, who say that we're looking at the genetic mother, then the genetics come from, or the genes come from more than one source. So this has been discussed in recent years. Rav Osher Weiss, one of the experts, of course, in areas of Jewish medical ethics, is of the opinion, misvara, based on logic, that it's impossible to have multiple mothers. He, we've seen Rav Osher Weiss on numerous previous occasions, and one of the things that always characterizes everything about Rav Osher Weiss is he's got a shita, which is, if it sounds ridiculous, it is ridiculous. And it can't be halachically. So his opinion is that you can't have more than one mother. A person can't have more than one mother. You can't have more than one father. You can't have more than one mother. Rav Eliashiv holds that you can, because it's a halachic concept some poskim hold that you can have more than one mother, not Rav Eliashiv, but others hold that you can have more than one mother. Rav Osher Weiss holds it's impossible to have more than one mother. So who's the mother in this case? So it's the mother that's providing the majority component of the genetic material. And that is the one that we would, the one who's conceived the baby, the one who's incubating the baby in her womb. That's the egg has come from her. A small bit of the egg is less than 1/1000th of the egg. That's a tiny percentage, and it's negligible. And therefore, Rav Osher Weiss holds that the mother is the one that's identifying as the mother. Other poskim aren't so sure about this, and indeed it's not just a Jewish debate that's going on there. It's a wider debate as well, ethical debate, parliamentary debate, legal debate, etc. One of the interesting phenomena in halakha, as far as this is concerned, is the fact that inevitably there are going to be lots of instances where we actually don't know about these cases, meaning that in some instances a frum couple will come to a rabbi and discuss with them, you know, where this is how we are going to be having children. This is how they're going to be conceived. What are the halachic issues? And they will get halachic guidance. But in many instances where it's not an observant, halachically observant family, so they will have a child born with a surrogate parent, a surrogate mother, or it'll be a three-parent baby, and they won't consult, they won't tell anybody, it won't be widely known, and the child will be known as a Jewish child because presented as the child of the parents. And it might have been hosted by a non-Jewish surrogate mother, which, according to some poskim, means that the child is not Jewish. According to others, means at least the child needs giur lechumra, some degree of conversion, just to be on the safe side. So this is an interesting halachic area where, you know, it's not going to be able to be supervised you know, properly, and in many, you know, it doesn't won't go on birth certificates that you know, certainly that it's a three parent child. I don't know what happens with surrogate motherhood, what goes on the birth certificate, but it's these are halachic issues which we won't be aware of, and you know, how that fits into the halakhic process is an interesting question. You know, maybe to some degree it's going to be self-defining. So that's the area that I wanted to discuss in terms of birth. Wanted to go on now to discuss a question in Brit Milah. Brit Milah is, yes, question from Bendov. Question that you're asking me there: to what degree do I think that the rulings of the poskim are influenced by hashkafa in addition to halacha? To some degree, that's quite true with every single question. Any halachic question, you know, there will be a hashkafic dimension to it as well. Not necessarily with regard to the bracha on a banana. But, you know, with regard to many, many questions, you know, Hashkafa will play a role. So, you know, I guess it will do, you know, here as well. Though from what I've seen, you know, in terms of what they've written, the Hashkafa might play a role in whether they say that, you know, this is good to do or not good to do. But, in terms of the halakhic conclusion that they've reached, bearing in mind that, you know, I can't see any obvious hashkafic ways to define this discussion. In terms of, I don't know how hashkafa would affect whether you regard it as a genetic mother or a birth mother. Now, they're both you know, everybody's looking just at facts on the ground. You know, whether or not it's something desirable is a separate. There's a separate question that they're addressing. So I don't think in this case it's significantly influenced. Let's move on now to Brit Milah. So Brit Milah obviously been around since the very dawn of Am Yisrael, and not an awful lot has changed, I guess, in the way that it's done. Might be a little bit more hygienic, I suppose. Things are sterilized, etc., etc. But essentially, it's I don't think it's had many changes. A question discussed in the course of the past, I suppose, 40 years, is the question of Brit Milah using laser surgery. Could you? We're used to the Mohel pulling out a scalpel and cutting with that. But could you have a high-tech Brit Milah using laser surgery? So one might say, why does one want to do that? Well, maybe in the times of Zoom, and you could have a Zoom Brit or something, or something like that. But the real answer is it's discussed with particularly with regard to haemophiliacs, where the foreskin could be removed without bleeding if it's done by laser surgery, as opposed to with the conventional scalpel. So a number of Poskim have addressed this question. I'm not going to look for a consensus in the Poskim, but I'm going to share with you a tshuva of Rav Osher Weiss, who discusses this question. Not everybody agrees with his conclusions, but if you look, it's on the second page of the source sheet on the right-hand column where he says, "Ve'emet yesh bazeh gimel she'elot shonot." He says, really, what it boils down to is three halachic questions. There's number one, Haim sarich kli v'davar mesuyam b'mila. Is there a particular din that brit mila has to be done with a keli, with an instrument? For example, there's certain mitzvot that have to be done with with an instrument. So, you know, I suppose, let's say, sprinkling the blood of the para aduma. Right, that has to be done. You have to take certain materials and sprinkle with that. And if you don't, sorry, sprinkling the water. And if you don't, and the ashes, if you don't use that instrument, then it's not valid. With a korban, when you shecht a korban, you have to, there's a din of Kabbalah, and you have to catch the blood in a keli. So with Brit Mila, you have to, Davka, do it with a keli or not. Second question is, Ha'im Mahani Hamila Afalul Odam Brit. Is it necessary in Brit Mila to have some blood loss or not? And the third question, Ha'im Yachol Lasot Gam Priya Al Yedei Keren Leisa, Ki Lo Priya Ein Mila Ve'en Geirut. Because the Priya is the second stage of the Brit Mila. The first stage is cutting off the Chituch. It's cutting off the foreskin, and then the second stage is the priya, which is peeling back the membrane. And could that be done through laser surgery as well, or does it have to be done with one's fingernails? And he addresses each of these questions in turn. He demonstrates that with regard to the first question, do you need to use a kli davka? So he cites various poskim who say, you know, it should be metal and this and that. He comes to the conclusion that in actual fact, this is only lechatchila, but in reality, anything that cuts off the mila is permissible. And in actual fact, he suggests are grounds to say that it's good to use a laser. He says the Lavush says you should use, why should you use, a sharp metal? Why should you use barzel, iron, or we call steel? Why should you use steel? Because it's charif biyoter ve'inu machiv kolkach. It's very sharp and it causes a minimum of pain. So a laser is even sharper and causes even less pain. So there could be room to say that, you know, there's a hiddur even in using a laser. He doesn't go that far, but he certainly says that demonstrates from a number of sources that using a kli is only lechatchila, but it's not absolutely necessary. The critical thing is that the foreskin is excised. So long as it's removed, that's good enough. Second question is about the dam brit. Is it necessary to draw blood? So he makes two observations here. He says, number one, so again, he brings grounds to say that it's not absolutely necessary. It would be valid even if no blood is drawn. But he says, even with laser, there would be a tiny bit of blood. There would be a little bit of blood, just like a scratch from a needle or something like that. And even if there wasn't, you could still do that scratch, what we call hatafat dam brit, and that would be an acceptable way of doing it. And then his third consideration, or his third question about the priya, There he raises the question about whether the priya can be done simultaneously with the cutting, or it needs to be a separate act. He makes two observations as far as that's concerned. He says, number one, there are some poskim that say actually the way it should be done is simultaneously with the cutting. Some very skilled ma'alim are able to do that. And he says, number two, that it's a reality of older males, that the membrane is stuck to the foreskin and is automatically removed together with the cutting, the severing of the foreskin, and therefore it's clearly not absolutely essential that the priya is done separately. So that's the tshuva of Rav Osher Weiss. Again, it's if anybody's thinking of using a laser moel for a child's brit, probably worth consulting with various halachic authorities in advance. And there are different opinions here, but I wanted to share with you the fact that this is a discussion. The final question I want to discuss is a question to do. No, penultimate. Flag up something else to do with mitzvahs, with brit mila, and this is the question of mitzitsa befeh. I've attached here an article which is written by Rabbi Chaim Jacht, available on his excellent website on the net, where he discusses Mitzitza. There are three parts to the procedure of Brit Mila. There's the cutting of the foreskin, there's the removal of the membrane, and then there's also the Mitzitza, which is drawing out the blood from the wound. And this is a Gemara in Masechet Shabbat, and appears in Shulchan Aruch, the importance of doing it. The question is, and this is discussed by the Achronim, is this something which is just a medical consideration, or is it an independent halachic consideration, part of that Mila is a three-part process? So if it's a halachic consideration, a medical consideration, if there's no medical grounds to mandate it, then it's not necessary halachically. If, however, it's a religious consideration, then even absent of any halachic any medical grounds to mandate it, it's still going to be necessary. Why do we ask this question? Because till maybe 50 years ago, maybe a bit longer, whatever, but till fairly recent times, mitzitza was always done invariably done by the moel directly sucking with his mouth the blood from the wound. In recent generations, moelim haven't wanted to do that necessarily, and parents haven't necessarily wanted that to be done. That it's quite an inviting way for the transmission of disease. So. Is this something that should be addressed? There's some ma'alim who are very insistent, some poskim who are very insistent that Brit Mila without Mila Befeh is totally non-existent. There's no such thing. It's not a valid Mila without that. There are others who say it is valid, that you can draw the blood in other ways. Just so long as the blood is drawn out, you can, there's a discussion whether you can use a sponge. I think this is a question that the Chatab Sofer discusses. Could you just place a sponge over the wound and draw out the blood that way? What many Marlin do nowadays is they use a tube, a sterile tube, so that they don't come into direct contact with the open wound. So this is a point of great discussion. Brought down in the name of Reb Chaim Soloveitchik, that he felt mitzitza wasn't necessary. And this article brings down in the name of Rav Soloveitchik that he wouldn't allow direct mitzitza befeh. This is the machloket poskim. Rav Moshe Sternbach is very emphatic. That you have to use, has to be done in the traditional way, direct application of the mouth. Dine Ehrentroy, when he was a moel, used a tube. So we've got a machloket here in the Poskim. It's an interesting question. Here at the end of the article, he quotes from the RCA, Rabbinical Council of America, issued a policy statement regarding the Tzitzit affair, which concluded as follows. The RCA urges its member rabbis, their congregants, synagogues and institutions, as well as the larger Jewish community, to encourage and wherever possible necessitate that the Tzitzit affair will be fulfilled via a tube. Every couple of years it comes up that unfortunately some child has died as a result of infection passed through the matzitz. So it's not every couple of years, that's unfair. It's once in a long while, but it does come up from time to time. So whether or not that's enough to be regarded as Sakana Hamatsuya or not, I don't know. It's certainly not good for public relations as far as Brit Milah is concerned. Interestingly, just to toss it out there, is an issue that somebody in the community raised a few years back, that perhaps at Ale we should have a communal policy that Brit Milah, taking place in the shul, cannot do traditional matzitzah affair, has to use a tube. I think these are the type of issues that that modern Orthodox communities should be addressing and should have policies on. Same time, it's very easy sometimes to have, we'll have policies about mitzitz, and we'll have policies about agunot, and we'll have policies about lots of other important things. It's always very easy to have, policies about what other people should do. Sometimes, it's good to have some policies about what we should be doing ourselves. I subscribe to the notion, whether or not it's good for our community at the moment, I don't know or not. But certainly, if anybody were to ask me, I would say the Mohel should do matzitza with a tube. Let's finish off with a question to do with Pidyon HaBen. It's not a modern question at all, but it's certainly contemporary in terms of that it's more prevalent nowadays than it was once upon a time. That's the question of Pidyon HaBen, whether father's not Jewish. So Pidyon HaBen applies to the Peter Rechem of a Jewish mother. That means if a Jewish woman, her firstborn child is a boy and it's not born by C-section and the father's not a Kohen or a Levi and the mother's not a Bat Kohen or a Bat Levi, the child needs Pidyon HaBen. And that's a mitzvah on the father to do. Father has a mitzvah to do Pidyon HaBen. The Gemara in Masechet Kiddushin says that if the father doesn't do Pidyon HaBen, then when the child becomes an adult, he has to do Pidyon HaBen for himself. So this happens from time to time. You have Chozeh B'Tshuvah, who was a firstborn. Parents never did a Pidyon HaBen. When they reach adulthood, they do a Pidyon HaBen. They might be 30, 40 years old when they become frum and learn this halakha. They might not even become frum. They might just become more traditional. And they want to have a Pidyon HaBen. So they do that. Question comes up in the classical poskim about what if the father's died before the Pidyon HaBen? Who does the Pidyon in that case? And this is a very similar question. It's a parallel question. There's no father here to do Pidyon HaBen. Who should do it? So it's a discussion. I've got here a tshuva of Rav Moshe Feinstein on the topic from Igrot Moshe Yordel, first Chelek. Simon Kuf Tzadik Hay. And he says there are those who say that where there's a no father, so perhaps the father's died, that the Beit Din or somebody else is allowed to step in and do Pidyon HaBen on behalf of the child. But there are others who say that actually they can't do that. Why can't they do that? Because they're depriving the child of his own mitzvah when he reaches adulthood. When a child reaches adulthood, he hasn't had Pidyon HaBen, then the mitzvah is incumbent upon himself to do Pidyon HaBen. So if somebody else just steps in and redeems the child, then they've denied him that opportunity of doing it himself when he's older. There's also a question of whether or not bichlal there's a notion of shlichut, of doing pidyon haben via an agency by somebody else. That's a point of machloket, though the general feeling amongst the poskim is that it's permitted. Rav Moshe Feinstein's conclusion on this matter is that a grandparent or communal representative can do pidyon haben on behalf of where the father's non-Jewish, and he actually says it's worthwhile. Why is it worthwhile to do that? Because the likelihood is the child won't know to redeem himself when he grows up. In terms of min hadin, the child could, and according to some poskim, this is the best way that he should redeem himself when he becomes an adult. It's just a question whether or not others do it, whether or not it's valid. The Rama talks about if there's no father or pidyon haben hasn't been done, so then you should make a little necklace for the child to wear, saying not redeemed, and he'll everybody else wears a Magen David or something, and this child will wear a necklace saying not redeemed, and he'll know when he's bar mitzvah that he needs to redeem himself. But Rav Moshe says nobody does that nowadays, and if they did, there's a good chance that it all get lost. And I would add in that in many, many instances where it's a non-Jewish father and a Jewish mother, the mother's involvement in Orthodox Jewish life is peripheral at best, and in many instances non-existent. And in 13 years' time, even if there's a grandfather who's a bit interested, you know, who knows if the grandfather will still be around, what the relationship will be. If you can do it while the baby is the child is still a baby, then that's the best way to do it. Some poskim say you should also do it again later, after when the child reaches 13, he should do it a second time. Rav Moshe says that's not necessary. So an interesting question would be: what if the mother's not interested? Let's say the maternal grandfather wants to do pidyon haben. You know, he's already twisted the mother's arm to do a brit milah. She wasn't so keen, and the non-Jewish father wasn't so keen. And now they're certainly not interested in doing a pidyon haben. What would the din be? You know, you can't get her to agree. That's an interesting shot, but you don't actually need the child to be there when you do the pidyon haben. So it seems that the grandfather could just go find a kohen, take the money to the kohen, say to the kohen, listen, you know, I've got a grandson who's a firstborn of his mother. Father's not Jewish. I would like to do pidyon haben on his behalf and redeem him. This is as a chut for him, that he's going to be redeemed. I'd like to redeem him. And lichora, that would be possible. So, again, as I've said on many occasions, contemporary halakhic issues can sometimes be contemporary because of a change in technical considerations. Sometimes it can be contemporary because of a change in societal considerations. So the first of the shailas that we saw with regard to conception and birth and with regard to Brit Milah were primarily technical considerations, whereas in terms of pidyon haben for a non-Jewish with a non-Jewish father, there's no technical distinction between today and previous generations. But certainly there is a societal and sociological difference, which is why it's a more common scenario for us to have to address. So that brings tonight's shiur to an end, and Be'ezrat Hashem, next week we'll be covering issues to do with bar and bat mitzvah. That's certainly a contemporary halakhic issue, because bat mitzvah didn't exist 50 years ago. So that's certainly contemporary issues, and a number of interesting shailas will come up with regard to bar mitzvah as well. So thank you all for joining us this evening, and Be'ezrat Hashem next week, same time, same place.